I made a conscious decision years ago to not let other people's actions affect my standards, my principles, my beliefs. I don't let other people's actions change me.
What's up, y'all? This is Michael Franti here. I feel so blessed today because I get to be just spending the next half hour, 40 minutes or so here on the Stay Human podcast with one of my favorite groups ever, a band that was super influential in me just getting started and just finding that love for music. And they were formed in 1978, naming themselves after the unemployment benefit form in the UK of UB40. And they released their debut album, signing off in August of 1980. So man, we're coming up on 40 years now, which is incredible. It's considered to be, by many, be one of the greatest reggae albums ever released. And it was the start of a career that has since seen 40, count them, 40 UK top 40 hits. Man, there's a lot of 40s in this whole thing.
That's because we've been 40.
Yeah. And,
we're
40 years old.
And with sales of over 100 million records, UB40 has seen their albums reside in the UK's top 75 album chart for a combined period of 11 years. Man, that just that number right there is alarming. Most bands don't even make it 11 years. But making UB40 one of the most successful British groups of all time and one of my favorite bands of all time. So please welcome here today Jimmy Brown and Robin Campbell of UB40. How you guys doing?
We're all good.
Good. Lockdown, but good.
First of all, where are you guys? Because we're doing this. I'm in Bali, and where are you guys?
Where are you?
What a terrible life is in Bali.
Bali. Oh, dear.
Beautiful, beautiful place. I mean, nothing like as beautiful place, but obviously we're both in England. We're both doing this from our respective homes. And I'm just south of Birmingham, and Jimmy's just north of Birmingham, or northwest of Birmingham.
Okay, I want to talk about Birmingham, because most people, when they think of music, at least most Americans, when we think of music, we think of everything is just London. And we don't really know about Birmingham, but there have been so many incredible groups and so many movements of music that have come through Birmingham. So why don't we start with you, Jimmy? Just tell me, like, what was life like for you growing up in Birmingham? The conditions there, what was your own family like there?
Well, I mean, it's worth saying, I think, there are other cities in England that are well known for me. Obviously Liverpool is well known, and you had the Manchester sound, which was part of the dance revolution in the 90s, and obviously you've got London as well. But with Birmingham, because it's so diverse, because there are so many different bands that come from Birmingham, from Duran Duran to UB40, to a lot of the heavy metal bands from the 60s and 70s, that there's no signature sound because of its diversity. What you've got is people from all parts of the world all pushed together into the centre of England and told to get on with it, really. It's not part of any medieval ports. There isn't really too much traffic coming to and from, you know, home countries the way there would be in a port. So it's kind of a unique place, Birmingham, and it's multicultural. That was the whole point. That's why we've ended up playing reggae, because we were born into an area, inner city area, that had a lot of immigrants from the Caribbean, obviously, as well as India and Arabs and whatever. You know, it was a real melting pot. But obviously, we went to school with the first generation of Black English, because their parents had come over with the Windrush generation and things like that. And a lot of kids were the first generation born in England that were our friends at school. And that's how we got into the music, really, was just being in an area where there was loads of reggae, because there was loads of sound systems, and, you know, they were trying to continue sort of cultural things from back home. So the sound system thing was imported. And because we were right up against, you could sit on my doorstep and see the four corners of the world go by. And that was a beautiful thing. Not quite.
It's a thing that doesn't exist anymore, really, isn't it? Because the areas have now become ghettoized, you know, where it's now a black area. The place I grew up in is a black area, mostly Asian area. But when we were kids, there was an influx from everywhere, as Jimmy says, every corner of the world. So it was a complete cultural melting pot. What we were listening to, you know, English pop music, the Beatles, Merseysound, etc., on the radio. But in the streets where we lived, what we heard was Jamaican pop music. And Jamaican pop music, even before reggae existed, you know, the ska and blue beats of the 60s was what I grew up on, you know. That's what me and my friends were, they were all English, but they were all second generation, you know. They were all first generation. They were all from all over the world. But what we were all listening to was the music that we loved from Jamaica. So it was Jamaican pop music that we were brought up on. It's why people often, you know, don't understand how a bunch of white guys could be listening, growing up on reggae. But that's because half of the band is not white, and that's a pretty good representation of how we grew up together. On the streets where we lived, if you grabbed eight kids off the street, they'd look pretty much like we did, you know, half black, half white, and the other half mixed.
And was there any tension at that time? Was there racial conflict in the community? Well,
there's always been racism, obviously. There was horrendous racism in the 60s. I can remember all sorts of horrible signs in windows, in bed sits, you know, saying no dogs, no Irish, no blacks, you know, that kind of... I mean, there was horrible racism, but it improved throughout our growing up years. It definitely improved and I think got swept under the carpet. I think it still existed, but it just got, it became unacceptable for a long time. And now it's kind of come back because of people like Trump and in our country, Johnson, you know, are making it acceptable to voice your racism and your bigotry again, you know?
Yeah, they've been mobilizing the racist vote ever since, for the last 10, 15 years. Things have got seem to me more racist now than maybe they were then. You were overtly racist then. You were allowed to say whatever you liked and people, you wouldn't get arrested for it. But since then, you know, laws have come in and, you know, equality laws and, anti-discriminatory laws have come in. But the racism really didn't go away. It went underground, you know, and got passed on through families. And then in the last 10 years or so, they've been given freedom to come out of the woodwork. But it never went away, you know, it was always there and probably always will be there. But we didn't even think about that. We were living in an inner city area that was mixed. So we didn't really think about it. They were our friends. So, you know, you didn't even think about that kind of racism.
Yeah. Jimmy, in the house that you grew up in, was it a musical home? Did your parents play any music? What did your folks do?
Well, I'm the opposite to Rob. I'm the only English member of the band. I have to say that. Everybody else in the band comes from somewhere else, but I'm a Brummie and I come from a normal working class English family, you know, who probably went along with a lot of the sort of racist attitudes that were around at the time, you know.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad worked in a factory all his life. Okay. He was a union man, worked in a factory, and that was in the days when working in a factory you could actually afford to run a house and have a family, and because you've got a decent wage working in a factory. Not like that anymore. Working in a factory now is the lowest of the low, and people get paid very little these days for manual work. But in those days, you could afford to have a house and it wasn't musical in any way at all. Can't remember having a record collection, but I personally was quite creative. So my parents were at least relaxed enough to send me to an art school where I met the rest of the guys in the band. So there was that creativity there personally in me. And that's how I got into music.
Yeah. So when was the first time you picked up an instrument?
When the band was formed.
Yeah.
You guys drew instruments out of a hat. It was like, okay, you're more playing trumpet, you're on drums.
More or less. I mean, anybody to be the drummer. But he was such a good singer, it would have been mad to waste that, you know. So I got the job of being the drummer. But I had played on a kit before and had a vague idea of what I was doing. But we all learned from scratch.
Yeah, except I was the only one in the band that knew any chords. I've been playing a guitar since I was a kid, really, since I was about 10. My father was a professional musician, so he played folk music. But when I showed, whenever any of us, well, there's four of us brothers, and when any of us showed any interest in an instrument, we would immediately find it thrust in our hands, you know. Here you go, son, learn to play this, you know. And my uncle gave me guitar lessons from the age of about 10 or 11. So, you know, I knew chords. I knew a dozen chords or so, you know, all the basics. But I'd never done anything except sit in my bedroom and strum along to a few tunes, you know. And when we formed the band, we literally argued over who was going to play what. It was a given that I was going to be a guitarist because I'd been playing guitar. And I showed Ali the chords, the basic chords, you know. And as Jimmy says, Ali wanted to be the drummer, but the rest of us told him he couldn't be because he had to be the lead singer. So he then picked up a guitar and played. So we were the two guitarists. Jimmy wanted to be the drummer. Brian already had bought a saxophone because he decided he wanted to be a sax player. Yeah. Earl got his dad to sign guarantor to buy a secondhand bass guitar. So that was it, really. And we had a friend who was a keyboard player, already had a keyboard, and he became our keyboard player for, I don't know, the first 6 months or something. And we lost him and got another keyboard player. But it was literally, you know, who wanted to do what? Norman always wanted to be our percussionist. So he became the percussionist, you know. It's that simple.
Before, I want to get into the music in a second, but before we do that, Robin, what was the hardest thing for you growing up as a kid? What was the most challenging aspect of being a kid for you and your family?
Well, I don't know. I don't think of anything that was really hard. I had a great upbringing. It wasn't wealthy, but we were loved and we were cared for and well looked after, you know, and well educated. We went to good schools. I guess, you know, I was possibly jealous of kids that had more, had a better life, nicer clothes or whatever, you know, when I was a kid. But basically, we lived across the road from a park. So I played football every day. I had a bike so I could ride around every day, you know. I had a good life as a kid. I don't think I really wanted for anything.
Did your dad travel around playing music or yeah. How was his? Okay. Yeah, Tell me about that a little bit.
I guess that would be the only thing that I missed out on, I guess, was time with my dad because he was constantly away touring, gigging. And I think that our life was probably a little bit distant from our dad, you know. It was pretty good when he came home. He was cool, but he could also be a bit of a monster. So he was a little bit of a disciplinarian sometimes, you know. So he was a little bit scary. Most of my mates were scared of him because he was a little bit, he barked a bit, you know.
When he was away, you four brothers were at home. And how did you guys occupy your time? Was there a lot of music going on or was it sports or was it a combination of just everything?
Everything. It was a normal childhood, you know. Creativity. I mean, two of the brothers were at art school with Jimmy. We were creative. We were very, very musical family. We were surrounded by music of all types. My mum was very open to all types of music. So when I started bringing in, you know, my Jamaican records, my mum loved them. Plus I was playing, you know, all the American stuff, Tamla Motown and Stax and all of that kind of stuff. I was a mad Sam Cooke fan as a kid as well, you know. And I used to play that stuff, the Drifters. I used to play to my mum, and my mum loved the Drifters.
Loved the Drifters, yeah.
And she'd be going, oh, play that Drifters album, you know, play that greatest hit stuff. And she was open to anything that we brought in, you know. My older brother was into American blues, and he had a massive collection. He worked in a record store as a teenager, and he either bought or stole, I'm not quite sure, a lot of blues records and had a large collection.
I'm pretty sure which one it was.
Yeah, but I'm not going to accuse him.
Yeah, okay.
Hey, Jim, was there, when you guys first got together, you guys getting some instruments together, you're kind of learning how to play, and then you get in a room and you're like, all right, we are going to be a reggae band. Did you guys ever just say that at some point, or did you try styles of music, or it just came to be the sound of UB40? I consider UB40, I mean, although I consider you guys one of the greatest reggae bands ever, when I hear your sound, I hear so many other influences. Even in the choice of songs, of the many covers that you've done, you've crossed the gamut of different styles of music, of the artists that you've, of songs that you guys have sung, and turned those songs in many times into bigger hits than the original artist did. So how did you guys, did you actually decide, like, we're going to be a reggae band, or was just a
We were never going to be anything else, you know. I mean, that was the music we loved. It was what we went out to listen to when we went out. That and you know, disco and funk. And because we're talking the 70s here, Rob's like about 30 years older than we are, so he remembers the bluegrass. But we were just responding to the Tamla Motown was in the charts. And so all those influences are going to be there, even the Beatles influences and, you know, and like the Everly Brothers with the harmonies. And, you know, I mean, it is an honest representation of the individuals involved in the band, because everybody has an equal say and is responsible for their own individual input into the band, you know. So those influences are going to come in, you know, and they never stop, really. So different influences are still coming in today.
Yes, precisely because our influences aren't 100% Jamaican, because we come from Birmingham, which is the cultural melting pot. I mean, Indian music, as you know, we've heard a lot growing up, and it may not even be a conscious influence, but you soak this stuff in, you know. When we were talking about forming a band, which was basically all the way through our teenage years, all we were ever going to be was a reggae band. And the thing that really was the catalyst for me was in 1976, when we saw Bob Marley in Birmingham. He played the Odeon Cinema in Birmingham.
Tell me about the Odeon Cinema, just so we can get a picture of what that's like.
That was a cinema house in the city centre of Birmingham that had become a live venue. It wasn't a cinema anymore. It had become a live venue.
What was the capacity?
2,500, 3,000 maybe.
Okay. 3,000, I think. Yeah.
Okay. At the most, about 3,000. But it was like an old-fashioned cinema, you know, with a ground floor and the
balcony.
Balcony, yeah. So it was a sort of prestige. It was before big arena type gigs existed, really, and it was the prestigious gig in Birmingham. That and the Birmingham Town Hall, which actually was smaller. So if you were a big band, you played the Birmingham Odeon, you know, and Marley played that, and we all went to that gig. And I remember saying to my younger brother, Ali, that's decided me. If you're ever serious about being in a band, instead of just talking about it, don't forget, count me in. I definitely want to be involved, you know. It took a couple of years, but finally, Ali, Jimmy and Earl came to me and said, okay, we're doing this. We're going to form the band. And that was
nice. Tell me about that show. What was it about the concert? Because I want to share with you, I had a similar experience seeing you guys. It was about 1982 or 83. I was in high school. I lived in a small town, and we went to see you guys at UC Berkeley, and it was opening for Midnight Oil. I remember being excited to see Midnight Oil because their song was on the radio all the time. And there was a reggae DJ on a radio station in San Francisco called the Midnight Dread. He had 1 hour a night on, I think it was only on like Sunday night or something, to play reggae. And he played one of your songs the week before I went to see you. And I had seen the first reggae artist I ever went to go see was Linton Kwesi Johnson. And I fell in love with reggae. I fell in love with dub. I heard you guys are opening, but I didn't know your music. And I went and saw the show, and I ended up being more excited about you guys than I did about Midnight Oil. And I'm still a Midnight Oil fan. I love Peter Garrett and everything he stands for and does. But seeing that concert left such an impression on me because of the groove, just the enormousness of the music and the bass and the drums and the way they're hitting, the beautiful harmonies, the melodies, you know, just the overall sound. Even your sound man was a big part of the act and just dubbing parts of the show. And I remember there was a light focused on him at one point. And like, never was the highlight of a show the sound person. You know, I'd never experienced that going to a concert, but at your show it was, and it really changed me. And I had a similar sort of feeling like, man, this is, I'm getting more serious about wanting to do this. And that fire started to build in me. So what did you see at that Marley show? What did both of you get? Did you, were you there too, Jimmy?
Yeah. We all went as a gang. Yeah. I mean, for a start, the feeling of excitement in the room when you walked in. I remember walking in and Third World was supporting and they were already on stage performing. They got drums set up in like a circle and they were doing kind of quite sort of cultural and Rasta influenced sort of singing. And just, it was an incredible atmosphere. You know, it was crackling with excitement. You know,
they were actually singing 96 Degrees when we walked in, weren't they?
Wow.
They were, yeah. But it was like crazy. An informal setup on stage. But, you know, the audience were just so ready for it. And it's probably the best concert I've ever been to. But, of course, that was the frame of mind I was in at the time. I was taking it all in, you know. I was only 2'4". This little white kid in the middle of a generally black audience, all getting excited because obviously there's that identity thing. A lot of black people will come out in Birmingham for something like that. You know, I mean, God, they're so starved of things to see that they even come out for the next Bad Boys movie. You know, when Bad Boys comes on, all the black people in Birmingham are going to go to the cinema to see it. And but at the time that was a real cultural event. And
and he was an incredible performer, wasn't he? I mean, it was the nearest thing to a religious experience, you know, because he was like the preacher, you know, and he got his congregation and he was just being adored for a couple of hours. He knew how to perform, that guy. You know, it was just something else. And for me, it was deeply, deeply moving, really emotional. It was something that just made me think, that's what I want to do, you know. And I mean, I've been watching performers all my life because of my dad's job. He'd introduced us to other performers. He ran the biggest folk club in Europe at the time, in the 60s. So we saw many, many people performing. Some of them were great performers. Some of them were fantastic and went on to be stars. But
Simon Garfunkel, I think, were there.
Paul Simon, definitely. Simon, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we had people sleeping in the spare bed in our house. You know, they would sing to us. And, you know, I mean, we were spoiled musically as kids, but nothing ever moved me like that concert. That Wailers concert was, and that was in the early days when the Wailers were still.
Just the Wailers.
The Wailers,
not Bob Marley. Yeah.
Not just Bob Marley. It was something else, you know. And that was what made me say to Ali, I'm serious. If you are, I really want to do it, you know.
Yeah. So then you guys, at what point did you make your first record? Just talk me through, like, you started playing some songs, playing some gigs, and then we have approached to make a record. You guys are just, let's go make a record on our own, or how did that come to be?
We played for about a year after we'd spent 6 months in a cellar learning to play together and writing our own material and stuff. We then spent a year on the road, but we only did about, I say on the road, I mean, we spent a year doing shows, and I think we probably did 30 shows in that year in total. Around the country. But we started to get a buzz, you know, and record companies were coming to us and making offers. And it was amazing how quickly it was happening. And I think we were very much carried along on the shirt tails of the two-tone movement that was going on at the time.
Yeah.
The whole ska thing, you know, the specials
and madness. And all that. Yeah, madness, yeah.
That whole scene was so hot at the time that we were carried along. It opened doors for us for definite, you know.
But we weren't coming from that. We weren't coming from there. We weren't coming from our own thing.
No, we were a reggae band. We weren't a revivalist. We weren't playing ska, etc., you know. And it used to annoy us intensely if people ever, described us as a ska band, you know, because we weren't playing ska, never did. But it did open doors for us, and we did have record companies coming and seeing us and making offers. But we never got a good offer, really. We never got an offer that we were prepared to accept because, one, we wanted complete control of artistic control, and we wanted a decent slice of the cake, you know. so many new bands are offered such lousy deals, you know, so they're earning nothing. And we were a big band. We weren't prepared to sell ourselves cheap, you know. I guess we were a bit arrogant as well, you know. We were full of ourselves. You know, we thought we were great.
That classic thing had happened, though, where we did like 1, 2, 3 shows in pubs, upstairs rooms in pubs, and then we decided, we're going to have a residency here. We're going to play this place once a month for however long. And the first time we played local, just a pub down the road, and the first time it was full. And the second time we played it, there was a lot of people locked outside. And the third time we played it, there were more people outside than could fit into the room. And that, you just knew something was happening, that you could feel the snowball developing. It was rolling, and then it just really developed quickly and grew big, so big in such a short amount of time. You know, it was classic band, you know.
And eventually what happened was that we were approached by an independent record company called Graduate Records, who had had a little bit of success in the charts. But basically the guy just came to us and offered to pay for us to make a record and split everything 50-50.
Wow.
Which was a massive deal for us. And he just totally, wholeheartedly believed in us. And we just went, yeah, go on then. Literally, okay, where do we sign? But the thing, the album was still made on the cheap, because we ended up making it in a guy's bedsit, you know. And he went to this guy's engineer who used to make demos for people locally and said, I want you to make their album. So we ended up an 8-piece band working in one room. It was difficult, and we did everything. All we had were 2 8-track machines linked together, so everything was bounced, you know, for the first album. It was real low-budget stuff. But, you know, it worked. And while we were recording that album, we were still doing gigs, and we played in London, and that was where Chrissie Hynde of The Pretenders came to our show, because she'd heard about us. She came to our show and offered us a tour. And she had a number one album and a number one single at the time, so, and a sold out British tour. So she could have taken anybody on that tour. And she saw us, liked us, and said, will you come on the tour with me? So we did a sold out British tour that year. And it was so popular, as you were saying, you know, that you were more interested in us even though we were the support band. The same kind of thing happened for us with the Pretenders tour. We got an amazing reaction, got great reviews, and we finished that tour, and our first record was released while we were on the tour, and we came home to a top 10 record. In fact, top 5 record. So
what was the first song that came out? What was the first single?
Food for Thought. Food for Thought, double A-side, Food for Thought and King.
Wow.
Which was a song about Martin Luther.
I want to talk about King, because, you know, right now we're in the midst of the Black Lives Matter movement, and there's so many people in my country right now who, like as you were saying before, Jimmy, feels like you've gone backwards in so many ways in terms of racism. And here you guys are writing this song about Martin Luther King, you know?
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, it's not really in praise of Martin Luther King. It's really saying, what difference did he make in the end? Where are we now? What's the result of all that? And the result was that really there was no difference, you know. People are still pacified, as it says, chained and pacified, you know. And really, I feel exactly the same now. I think there has been absolutely no change whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. I remember hearing that song.
The change that has happened is cosmetic, you know.
Yeah. I remember hearing that song for the first time and just sitting in a buddy's, we were just in San Francisco in a little flat getting stoned like everybody did, you know, at that moment, and rolling a spliff up on that album cover and talking about the band. And then that song came on, King. And I just remember those opening chords and just how haunting and beautiful that melody is on that song, and the vocals. And as you said, those lyrics of describing this sort of ambiguousness of, you know, where are we now? Where have we come as people? And how could we have suffered so much, and so many people have led and been so strong in this journey, yet we're still not where we need to be, or where King's dream would hope us to be at that point. I want to talk about, because the sound to me was so important of that record, hearing it. I remember my buddy played guitar, and I didn't play any instruments at the time, but he said, hey, play the bass on this one. It was 12 bar. So I actually learned how to play like a 12 bar blues scale, trying to pick out that bass line on it. So right, tell me about the sound. Yeah. Tell me about the sound. How did you guys come up with the sound? You know, you're using 2 8-tracks. Like, were you guys deeply involved in the mixing and everything? Or were you just kind of like, whoa, you know, was it all kind of just new to you? Or
we were 100% involved in everything about the making of that album. I mean, we had a guy called Bob Lamb, who was a drummer with a band, the Steve Gibbons Band, which was a Birmingham rock pop group. And he was the drummer. They toured with The Who, so he'd earned a little bit of money. And he built himself a little studio in his flat, in his apartment, you know. He was the engineer, and he knew what he was doing technically. We had no idea technically, but we knew what we wanted to sound like, and we knew what we wanted to happen. It had to be dubby, it had to be spacey, it had to be, because the greatest influence on the younger guys in the band would be the dub, you know, of reggae of the 70s. Whereas for me, it's the rock steady period of the late 60s, you know, and that's because of the difference in our age. But there's all these different influences pulling in different directions. And that's what makes the sound of UB40, is the fact that we give each other head, you know. That sounded terrible.
Yeah, I'd love to say that.
Is that all you got to do to make great records? You should have told me that years ago.
Not that I'm against. No, but, you
know. what I mean is we don't try and control what the other guys contribute, you know.
Okay,
Each person makes his contribution on his instruments and in his way and with his own influences. And because we're not Jamaican and we're not only listening to reggae, different guys in the band listen to different things and have different other favorite musics, you know. Jimmy was into all sorts of weird jazz drum,
Billy Cobham, and you know,
Billy Cobham, exactly, stuff I never listened to, you know, whereas I was also listening to things that they weren't listening to, like, I don't know, like the Everly Brothers, and you know, all those things play on the different influences and pulled the music in different directions, but we still had a thing that we were trying to do, you know. We still all knew the sound that we were trying to make, and we pulled Bob Lamb, the engineer, we pulled him along with us. He loved what we did, and he basically just went, you know, you tell me what you want, you know. And we ended up on a mixing desk with like 8 pairs of hands. Or because there was no computer automation.
Animation.
You know?
Yeah.
It was all done by.
You get to the second verse, you push that button, turn that knob.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone had a hand on the slider.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I forgot to push the button. And then, yeah, you know, we got to do it again.
Exactly. Yeah. We'd get almost to the end and someone missed their cue and we'd have to go back to the beginning, you know. But that was exactly how we did the first several albums. But the first one was of major importance because we just kept saying to him, you know, you do what you do, but you got to let us do what we do, you know. And bless him, he was basically just sat there and said, what do you want me to do, you know, and allowed us our free range to have fun, you know, and to make the sound that we were determined that we were going to make. And of course, it didn't sound like anybody else. It didn't sound like a Jamaican act. And it didn't sound like a two-tone act. It sounded like us, you know? I mean, that's what you want, is to have a unique sound that no one else sounds like, you know?
Yeah. That's what I think has been, I guess, the key to the longevity that you guys have had, and just how many, you know, as I was describing earlier, how many hits that you have had over decades. And every time a new song would come out, it would be like, okay, here's a new track, but it sounds like UB40. And this is a sound that it appeals to me. It's a sound I like. I mean, it doesn't matter if I'm in Hawaii, doesn't matter if I'm in here in Bali, where your music is love, if I'm in East Africa, where we were last year, and I heard your records getting played all over the States. if I'm in Araka Mesa in Jamaica, they love you. You know, it's like the records are, and the sound is bigger than just, you know, one moment. And that's how so many bands are. There's just one moment. But you guys, how did you start doing the covers that you guys did? I mean, I know on the first record there was one, right? Strange Fruit.
Oh, we did a couple. There were a couple. We did the Randy Newman song as well. I think it's going to rain.
Okay.
It was on the first album. Yeah. So for us to do covers was not, it was not a strange thing. It was not an alien thing. I mean, a lot of record companies were saying to us, you mustn't do covers. You know, you're known for your politics. You're known for your stance, you know, and your political stance, you know. And we were just saying, yeah, but we like doing other people's songs too. You know, there's not a problem for us. When we suggested that we do an album of covers of reggae records that we grew up on, that was, the record company just went, that's commercial suicide, you know, that you're crazy. Why would you do that? You know, write your own material. Why would you want to do an album of covers? And we were saying, because the question we get asked is, why do we play reggae? Why do we love reggae so much? And all we wanted to do was show them the records that we'd grown up on, the records from the formative years of reggae. Even more so from my point of view, which is why it was my idea, really, to do the Labour of Love series. Well, the first Labour of Love album was my idea because I was at that age when Rocksteady happened, and that is my era as a young teenager. That was what made me fall in love with Jamaican pop music, you know. It was the Rocksteady era when it changed from ska. That intermediate stage between ska and reggae was the Rocksteady period of 66, 67. That period was, for me, my formative years, and was also reggae's formative years. And I wanted the rest of the world to hear the songs that we loved as kids that had never had, you know, the exposure. And we were convinced as kids, if only this would get played on the radio, it'd be a number one record, you know. And it was number one in the reggae charts. So those were the songs. They were all hits in the reggae charts, but not outside of that. And we heard them everywhere we went, the youth clubs, the bars, the cafes, wherever we went, where we lived, we would hear those records as kids. So we had a list of songs. We actually, I compiled a list of songs, and we argued over which ones we would do. Some of them were automatic and some of them took a little bit longer, but that was how we came up with the list, you know. It was
we're still working through the list, aren't we? I mean, you
absolutely,
know,
yeah.
100 or so.
Yeah, I ended up with a list of 200 songs. Yeah. And we've now done four volumes of the Labour of Love series, you know. And literally, we could keep doing that forever. What we have to do is put that away and go, right, now we're going to do our own stuff, you know.
Yeah. Jimmy, when you guys get started on an album and writing, how does that process take place?
Well, generally, you'll get me and the bass player. We'll go in the studio first and we'll work up a blank sheet.
Bass and
drum. Create some backing, trying to imagine a song and create a backing to an imaginary song. And then you get those backings, and then we individually, the three or four members who write lyrics, and then it's a case of marrying the lyrics to the music. Then other times we did with the new album, Dunk bought a couple of songs with the melody as well, you know, which was kind of unusual for us. We worked the two separately. So, you know, we're really quite open to, there's no fixed way. That if somebody gets like an idea for a beeline, the bass player's not going to go, oh, no, that's my job. You know, it's just everybody throws ideas in, you know, and that's how we do it in the end. But yeah, I think I'm kind of used to working from the blank sheets and working up a tune from nothing, which I think can be quite difficult sometimes, you know, when you're looking at that.
And because we're not musically trained, we do everything in a very long, you know, long-winded fashion. Because we don't write music or read music or anything like that. Everything, you know, we're self-taught and we write by jamming. But generally, Jimmy and Earl, being the foundation of the music, the bass and drums, they work on stuff on their own together. They may have me, or they may have Tony, our keyboard player, just doing chords, you know, simple chords. And that's how we start off with a basic instrumental that becomes a backing track because people add things, and then someone else will bring a lyric and maybe a melody, and that will get married to one of the backing tracks. You know, people just get, when you're playing together, when you're jamming together, people get ideas, and they'll go, oh, I've got an idea for a tune or a lyric or whatever, and they'll bring that back, and then you continue to work on it. I mean, as Jim said, Duncan, our new lead singer, who's only been with us for 12 years, he wrote two different lyrics for the latest album, and he had melodies for both of them. One of the melodies we loved, and the other melody we hated. So we kept sending him away and going, work on it some more, you know. That doesn't sound right, you know. It sounds like a folk tune. And he'd go away and he'd come back a bit, and he'd sing it us, and we'd go, yeah, well, it's better than last time, but it's not great. And he was getting really frustrated. And I said to him, think someone else. Don't just think of the... Channel Stevie Wonder and channel Bob Marley. Do that, yeah. And you'll come back with the tune. And
that's literally, not a bad weeks, mix right there.
Two weeks later, he came back with a tune that didn't sound like Stevie Wonder or Bob Marley, but it was a great melody. And we went, there you go, perfect. Put it down, you know. And it's that kind of really slow, long-winded process that we do. You know, we're not quick. Although some tunes can come quickly sometimes, but you know, we prefer to work the way we do, and it's, I don't imagine it's going to change now after 40 odd years.
No, I don't think so, no.
So it's been 40 years now. Are you guys, you know, this has been a crazy year for everybody with COVID, and when things do open up again, is your plan to hit the road again and be out there touring like we have before, or Has the online experience opened up new things for you guys and thinking of doing things differently, or are you still essentially?
Yeah, both really, you know.
Doesn't he ask the perfect questions, Jim?
Yeah. Because actually, we haven't answered half of these questions ourselves, really, you know. Okay. What are we going to do when it all comes, you know? Well, you know, hearing about the vaccine was really hopeful. I'm really, that was a real sort of, you know, that made me feel, well, hang on a minute, we could be back working by halfway through next year, maybe, you know. I'm hoping that's going to be the case. And yeah, I mean, for a start, Zoom allows us all to control our business better, because we can have meetings at the drop of a hat. We don't all have to gather together in a room somewhere to do it, you know. So in some ways, we'll continue with that and collaborating with other people online, and that's been a really good thing to do. But we want to get back on the road. That's what we do best.
Yeah, I mean, lockdown has kind of killed our touring. We had a year of touring for this year completely booked out. We were going Australia, New Zealand, America, Africa, Europe. We had a UK tour for this Christmas, so we had the whole year booked out solid, and it's all been moved to, you know, ostensibly it's been moved to next year. So we'll have another busy year next year if it happens that we can tour. Hopefully, that's looking likely. But we'll be doing next year all the stuff we should have been doing this year. But lockdown has enabled us to do all sorts of things that we wouldn't have done otherwise, like completing collaboration. We've got a collaboration album that we've done with other artists from around the world. During lockdown, we've completed it, and it's ready for release now. We've got in touch with artists we've met around the world and or worked with around the world, and asked them to put their songs onto our music from our last album. We've sent them our backing tracks and said, put a song on it, you know. And the response was brilliant, and we've got another album waiting to go, you know. Plus, of course, while we've been locked down, we've also launched our own app, which has made a massive difference to how we communicate with our fans, you know. We do a live Zoom just like this every Sunday, every week, where we talk to our fans, you know. We have question and answer sessions, plus we play them new material. They get new material before anybody else hears it, you know. Plus, we have guests on, like you, Michael.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if you'd come on and
I'd be happy to. I'd love to.
Our fans would just love to hear you, you know. And we've had people we've collaborated with. We've brought them onto the Zoom and talked to the fans and stuff. And it's just a great way of being in touch. As you know, it's a great way of being in touch with your fans, you know, and keeping the channels open. And in fact, it's even better than it's been when we were on tour. People only saw us at a distance. Now it's far more intimate. We get to talk to people up close and personal. It's a great way of doing things. And it's something we're going to continue to do after lockdown. You know, we're going to keep this thing going and obviously keep the app going anyway. But also we like the idea of doing a Zoom, even if it's not weekly, we'll do it as regular as possible, you know,
I just wanted to say, we're really lucky. We're a heritage band, as they say. We've got all that history. So taking a year off isn't going to destroy us, you know, hopefully. You can't take anything for granted, you know. But I feel sorry for other bands where maybe they built up some momentum in last year and all of a sudden that's come to a stop, you know. They can't perform. So I feel sorry for bands having to deal with that. But I think we're very lucky that we can maybe just bridge over this little time, and hopefully it won't have a big effect on the future.
It's also the way people earn a living as well, you know. I mean, it's musicians don't make money out of selling records anymore. They make money playing live, you know. And it's not just the musicians. There's a whole support structure of technicians. And, I mean, my guitar tech at this moment is a delivery driver because he can't get work with us. Obviously, I can't support him. So he's out doing a job as a delivery driver until we get back on the road again, you know. And that's just the case for hundreds of thousands of people in our country. There are close to, I don't know, 200,000 people who work in our business, you know, that aren't just musicians, they're technicians and support staff, you know.
It's amazing how governments are. I don't know how it is exactly in England. I know it's similar to what's going on in America, but in America, the government doesn't really seem to see music or the entertainment industry as an industry at all, and we haven't seen the same kind of financial support that banks, for example, have.
For an industry that brings in billions into the economy, it's incredible how badly our industry's been treated. You know, people just aren't getting looked after. The support structures that have been set up for normal working people doesn't work in our business because, for different reasons, they fall through the cracks, you know. People in our business aren't getting looked after and aren't getting helped, you know, and it's a pretty depressing situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing unusual for rich, white, middle-aged men to not really have much of an idea of what goes on in the streets culturally, you know, and that's where music comes from a lot of the time, you know. It's coming from people on the street, you know, and of course that can be subversive as well. So I don't think it's really that, you know, that musical culture is on the horizon for these people. You know, a right-wing Republican isn't going to really care if a ballet dancer or a guitarist or whatever hasn't got a job. You know, it's not in their universe, is it? So we won't be considered.
Yeah, I got two more questions. First one is more of a thought, though. You know, there's a whole new resurgence of reggae in America. There's tons of young bands that are just getting started, and they're seeing reggae as this as a new outlet and a new opportunity. And a lot of them grew up listening to your guys' music. So I want to say thank you on behalf of all the new reggae bands that are out there in America. But also, I just want to ask you guys, do you have any thoughts, any advice for bands that love reggae that are just getting started, and how, you know, just any advice for them to be them their best?
I mean, the beauty of reggae is that it's approachable, you know. I mean, when we started the early 70s was prog rock, and that was totally unapproachable for anybody who didn't go to music school, you know. So reggae has got that sort of it is inclusive kind of music. It's also not a thrash, so your mom and dad can enjoy listening to it, you know. So it's got that real wide appeal, and there's a simplicity to it. And if you understand the music, It's quite easy to reproduce. You know, you don't need virtuoso musicians to do it, you know. But I do think if you're going to be a band, what I do believe is that you need to share everything. If you're going to try, if you're going to stay together and you want longevity, then sharing everything equally seems to me to be a good way of keeping the band together. Because otherwise, bands will just fall apart after a couple of years and the songwriters go on one way and the other musicians get forgotten. I think sharing is a good thing.
From the beginning, that was exactly what I was going to say. From the beginning, we've always shared everything equally between the eight members of the band, you know. Whoever makes, it doesn't matter what contribution you make, the contribution you make, that is your contribution, and you get an equal share for that, you know. And it doesn't matter that there's a nucleus of three or four writers. Those three or four writers share whatever it is that, that the song earns between the eight, you know, and always have done and always will do. And I think that is the secret to keeping a band together. I mean, we've lost a few members of the band along the way in the last 10, 12 years, but we kept a band together for 30 years, you know, which is kind of unheard of for most bands. You know, most bands split up over what they call musical differences. And generally that tends to be financial differences, you know. And we've tried our best to make sure that there are no financial differences in our band, you know. And I think that that's, you know, that's the glue that keeps a band together.
Yeah, and everybody has a stake in it, and that means everybody will give 100% because it means something to them individually.
Yeah. So my final question is the question that I ask everybody who's on this podcast, and it's the Stay Human podcast. We live in a world that is trying to constantly suck the humanity out of us. And, you know, it's like we pick up social media, we read the news, whatever it is, and we feel like, man, or at least I feel like, man, I'm just this one tiny person in this vast world of fuck-ups. What could I possibly do to make the world be a better place, or even just to hold on to my sense of who I am and just being me? So I'd like to ask each of you guys, what does it mean to you just to be a human being, and how do you hold on to your humanity? Robin, you want to start?
Not really. That's a difficult.
Okay, Jimmy, you go.
Well, you know, yeah. I think, you know, in the end, we're a big band and we're also a bunch of mates. So you keep your eye on each other. And if somebody acts in a way that's not right, and you know that with a friend, you know, if a mate's not acting in a way that you think they're going to normally act, then you'll say something and you go, well, why are you acting like that? Or why are you saying that? You know? So we're keeping each other's feet on the ground. And also for me personally, I'm still with the woman I was with before the band started. So that really helps, I think, to keep your feet on the ground. Because that's the most important thing, is not getting carried away with your own fame, you know, because people take it too seriously. And we just take the piss out of each other. If somebody starts acting in a way that we don't approve of, then we'll all just bully them into thinking straight. You know, you go, well, I've known you
for 30 years.
Exactly. You know, why are you acting like that now? You never used to be like that. You know, and that will keep your feet on the ground. You need people around you, people you can trust, and it's not always easy to work that out. But that's kept up my feet on the ground anyway.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think the friend structure that we've kept around each other, you know, has kept us level-headed, kept our feet on the ground and kept us normal. And I think the one thing that we often find, the reaction that we get from people is that we are so normal for people who have been in the limelight for 40 years, performers, etc., that we haven't gone on this mad ego trip, you know, where people are always surprised by how normal we are, you know, how down to earth we are, etc., you know.
When you've got families as well, you know, I mean, your kids have got to go to school. They got to deal with other people as well. So if you put yourself on a pedestal, then that's going to rub off on the kids and maybe build up resentment with, you know, my kids went to the local school, you know, they did used to go to private school, but eventually they went to the local school. And you've got to get them to school, you've got to live a normal life, Otherwise, they're going to get bullied if you're not careful, you know.
Yeah. And for me personally, I made a conscious decision years ago to not let other people's actions affect mine, affect me, affect my standards, my principles, my beliefs, whether that's, you know, political or whatever, you know. I don't let other people's actions change me, and I try not to react in a negative way to people, whether their actions are negative or positive. I try and stay true to myself. That's all you can do, I think.
Yeah. Man, this has been awesome to talk to you guys. I feel like I had gone for a couple more hours. maybe we'll have a chance to do it again some other time. Yeah. But I just want to just once again say thank you for the way that your music has touched my life and inspired me to do what I do, both as a voice for social justice in the music, but also just as music that makes people or helps people get through the most challenging times in their lives. And right now we all need UB40 music. So if you're listening to this right now, finish this podcast, go, you know the songs, you know, Red Red Wine and all that kind of stuff, but I want you to go and turn on the very, very first album of Signing Off and just start there and then go back through the history of UB40 all the way up to their present album For the Many, and get the app, find out what they're up to, watch their Zooms, and there's just so much insight and history here, not only from their own music, but from the records and artists that they grew up loving that it finds their way into their music today. So thank you guys for just being amazing gifts to the world of music. I just feel really honored to have had you on the podcast today, and I look forward to hearing is it Bigger Bag of Rhythm, is that the next one?
Yeah.
That's going to be coming.
Yeah.
All right, after Little Bag of Rhythm. So we look forward to hearing that record.